I'll begin with the definition, which is a very streamlined modern definition, and then explain it. But many of you have heard lots of lectures over the years about this topic, and even a series of lectures last week about it. So the definition is that an n-dimensional TQFT is a symmetric monoidal functor F from Bordism category with disjoint union mapping to, say, complex vector spaces under tensor product. So that's a very streamlined, as I said, definition. Let me explain a few of the terms just to make sure that this corresponds to the usual definition. So this is a map of categories. So the categories have objects and morphisms. What are the objects here? The objects here are n minus 1 manifolds Y, which are closed. And we should think of them as also coming with an arrow of time. So they have a little arrow in a one-dimensional normal direction. And what the functor F attaches to it, F of Y, is a complex vector space, which is an object in this category. And a map in the Bordism category, if I have a manifold Y naught, which is an n minus 1 dimensional closed manifold, and I have a manifold Y1, then a Bordism is a compact n-dimensional manifold X. So this is compact. And you see, a compact manifold gives you an arrow of time, if you like, a coloring of its boundary. And the incoming boundary, where the domain of the morphism, that arrow of time points in. And in the codomain, it points out. And what this gives you, then, is a map F of X from F of the incoming part of the boundary to F of the outgoing part of the boundary, just the linear map of vector spaces, which are the morphisms in that category. And saying it's a functor, well, I can compose Bordisms by gluing. I compose linear maps by composition. And gluing has to go to composition. Saying it's a monoidal functor, here, the monoidal structure, a product of two manifolds, is the disjoint union. That has to go over into the tensor product of vector spaces. So as I say, that's a very streamlined definition of what a field theory is. Now, typically, there will be some extra structure here on these manifolds. We might have, for example, an orientation on the manifolds. We might have some sort of framing. Spin structure, etc. So there are various decorations one could put here. And there are various alternatives one could put here. You could take abelian groups with tensor product. You could take differential graded vector spaces, differential graded abelian groups, and so on. So there are lots of variations on this definition. Now, one comparison that's nice to keep in mind when one thinks about topological quantum field theory is to compare to the definition of a cohomology theory. So a cohomology theory is also a functor from some sort of spaces to something algebraic. But the domain is, say, all topological spaces, again under disjoint union, not manifolds. And the codomain, well, we could take, again, say, complex vector spaces. But an important difference is that in cohomology, disjoint union goes over to sums, not to tensor products. So quantum theories is some sort of exponentiation, if you like, from what happens in classical cohomology theory. Here, in addition, there's, of course, a Mayer-Vieth-Forest property, which one has to encode. Now, the aspect that I want to focus on today is what we might call a sort of extended version of this definition. This definition so far just has two dimensions in play, n minus 1 and n. So we might call this an n minus 1 comma n theory. But if we extend, we can bring in more dimensions. So for example, if I have a manifold of dimension m, we can make a little chart and see what f of m is. So in an n-dimensional theory, here if I have m which is closed, then if I have an n-dimensional manifold, we just get a number, which is an element of the complex numbers. So you see that from this definition, because you see, if I have a closed manifold here, then its boundary is empty. I have to know what the empty set goes to. The empty set is the unit under disjoint union. That has to go to the unit under tensor product, which is just the complex numbers. So it tells you that a closed manifold gets assigned a complex number. An n minus 1 manifold, we already said, gets attached to complex vector space. And now if we continue, well, an n minus 2 manifold, everyone's familiar that this should be a complex linear category. So that's certainly important in the geometric Langlands story, because there n is 4, it's a four-dimensional field theory, and it's important that to a surface are attached complex linear categories. We can think of these objects as having what I like to call a category number. So a category has category number 1. That's a 1 category, if you like. A set, this is a set, has category number 0. This is a number, has category number minus 1. And you can imagine that this chart continues, and we would get some kind of 2 category here, perhaps, of category number 2. And if you're Dante, you can even continue the circles right on down. Now, it's also interesting, by the way, to think about this chart in comparison to cohomology theory. And in cohomology theories, in algebraic topology, you can also encounter these more refined invariants. We can make the cohomology groups, or cohomology spaces, we can make those into something you would extract from a 1 category. We can refine that 1 category to a 2 category, and so on. So if you want finer invariants in algebraic topology, you might also think of walking down this circle of higher categories. But there's a fundamental difference between the ones that occur here and the ones I'm thinking of occurring there, which is that the ones that occur in topology are groupoids. That is, the arrows in the category all have inverses, because they're all made from homotopies. And in a homotopy, you have the opposite homotopy, which just runs the homotopy backwards. And since they're groupoids, they can really be encoded by spaces. So there's an alternative way to encode the information in a cohomology theory in terms of spaces. And, well, that gets made a little bit fancier into spectra that really encodes that kind of Mayer-Vitoris property I mentioned. But ultimately, it's in terms of some kinds of topological spaces. And perhaps there's a possibility that the kinds of information that's encoded in this higher categories that occur in field theories, maybe there's an alternative place that might encode that data. I don't know. In any case, what I want to say today when one starts discussing these categories and higher categories, the discussions tend to get sometimes a little bit, they get a little bit general and get a little bit hard sometimes, I think, to hold on to things. And so what I thought I would do today is tell you two more concrete things, actually, about some particular examples where one sees this higher category structure, but sees it in a very concrete way. So one of the things is very old, I'm afraid, and one of the things is very new, also afraid. So both of them have to do with what's called Chern-Simons theory. Not geometric Langlands. And in the Chern-Simons theory, first of all, I should tell you that n is equal to 3. So to a 3 manifold, that are complex numbers, to a surface, a two-manifold vector space. And if we're able to go down to one manifold, a C-linear category, and then really one of the subjects of the talk is what's attached to a point. So you see, according to this definition, we might think of Chern-Simons theory as a what I might call a 2-3 theory, meaning a theory of two and three manifolds. The Chern-Simons theory, however, has the nice feature that it's really a 1-2-3 theory, and there is something attached to the circle, which is a C-linear category of a very special type. And in fact, I'd like to say that at least in some cases, we know what it is as a 0-1-2-3 theory. We can go down to points. So there's a whole collection of these Chern-Simons theory given by two pieces of data, G, which is a compact Lie group, and L, the level, which is a class in H4 of BG, and here I mean with integer coefficients. And this is what's called the level of the theory. So these two pieces of data give a theory, which we could call F sub GL. It's the closest I'll come to geometric language. And you didn't get the jokes, I had to make it explicit. All right, so, well, I don't know. My arms weren't long enough when I started trombone to reach seventh position, and now I'm re-encountering this difficulty. But so the two cases I want to talk about are when G is a finite group, and there I wrote a paper quite a long time ago, and yes, FTH did exist then. Okay. And this paper discussed the finite group in the context of these categorical ideas in a very heuristic way. And I want to just kind of indicate, although I won't go through it in detail, some particular computational kinds of aspects there, but also discuss in that context what is attached to a point, which is there. And then I want to discuss the case when G is a torus, so a compact connected abelian Lie group, that's a torus. And this case, as I said, this is new. This is sort of ongoing conversations with Constantine Telemann, Jacob Lurie, Mike Hopkins, and everybody else. And so this is kind of ongoing. So I'll tell you in that case a little bit about what is attached to a point here. Now, there's one fundamental difference between these cases. And for a finite group, and this really is one of the main points of this old paper, is that one can give an a priori construction of Chern-Simons for a finite group, namely the path integral, which is a heuristic construction in many cases, at least to mathematicians, of a field theory. But it is a priori in the sense that the gluing laws, the functoriality, has a geometric origin when you give a path integral. You see, fields are local, the action is local, they obey similar gluing properties, and it's a formal argument, if you can define things from a path integral, to say that you get a functor in this way that obeys gluing. So that's what I mean by an a priori argument. And for a finite group, the path integral is just simply a finite sum. So one can really do it, and you get an a priori construction. The game here was to extend the idea of a path integral, which is done in three dimensions in this three-dimensional theory, to really think of what you get in lower dimensions as also being a kind of path integral, so you get a priori gluing laws. The constructions of Chern-Simons for groups of positive dimension are definitely more of the type of generators and relations, the mathematical constructions. So for example, they might start with a lot of algebraic data, say coming from a quantum group or some other place, and then say that this is attached to various building blocks of two and three manifolds, and then check all sorts of relations to say that that gives a consistent theory. So that's a kind of generators and relations picture that's not derived from the classical picture of fields so directly. In fact, also one of the goals here was to see for me at the time, to try to understand why the beautiful differential geometric turn Simons that I knew and loved had anything to do with quantum groups, with which I had a very different relationship. And so a finite group was the place where I could do that. Okay, so let me start by talking about the finite groups, and just to say this idea of the path integral, even though I'm more interested in what happens in zero and one dimensions, let me say in three dimensions. So a lot of this talk is going to be, in these two cases, about the geometry of what a class in here gives you. So what it gives in this case is the following. So supposing that G, as I said, is a finite group. Well, in this case, the fields in your theory, again, we have classical fields. The fields are principal bundles over your manifold X, let's say, with structure group G. So in covering space theory, these are called Galois G covers. Although the total space, of course, need not be connected, but you can think of it as a principal bundle whose structure group is this finite group G. So in gauge theory in general, we think of a principal bundle together with a connection, but for a finite group, there's a unique connection on this bundle. So the collection of these fields is not a set because we have gauge transformations. So these fields actually have a groupoid. We can have symmetries, invertible maps between between these fields. Now in this case, the action is what this cohomology class, this level, gives you. So for a finite group, it's true that H4 with integer coefficients is isomorphic to H3 with, let's say, R mod Z coefficients. And, well, you know that cohomology classes on the classifying space, one way to think of them is just as functorial cohomology classes you get on the base of any principal G bundle. So anytime I have a principal G bundle, what a class in here means is that I get a class on the base here, a three-dimensional class with coefficients in R mod Z, and it's functorial anytime I have a pullback of bundles, not necessarily isomorphic, just a pullback of bundles, then the class pulls back. So that's what a class here gives. That's a characteristic class, in other words, for principal G bundles. So if X is a three-manifold which is closed, compact without boundary, and also oriented, so I know how to integrate, then we can define the action is just this cohomology class. Well, if I called it L, then I guess it's L of P, evaluated on the fundamental class of X, which is defined there. So we might think of that as an integral. This is in R mod Z. So that cohomology class gives you a classical action. And then the path integral, if I want to define the quantum invariant, f of x, then what I should do is integrate that, do the path integral over all fields, G covers. Well, that's going to be a sum, then, over all p of, well, it's e to the, I guess, 2 pi i times this action. So that's right. The path integral is e to the 2 pi I times the action times a measure. And what is the measure? Well, this is a discrete space of fields, so a measure is just a weighting on each field. And how do I weight things? Well, I have to count them by dividing by the number of automorphisms. That's always how we count. But of course, I don't sum over all fields. I mean, that wouldn't make sense. We have to sum over isomorphism classes of fields. And we use the fact this is gauge invariant, if you like. Just depends on the equivalence class of P. It's a characteristic class. So that's what the path integral reduces to. And for such a manifold, there's just a finite number of such bundles up to equivalence, and so that's a finite sum. So that's just to give you an idea of how we get an invariant, as I said, from the path integral. And the important point is that both the fields, these kinds of principal bundles, and this characteristic class are both local. That is, I can chop it up. For example, if I have my three-manifold divided along a surface, I would get something in two pieces and be able to define something and recover it. But it's even more local than that. We can cut it down to points. so completely local. Pardon me? How do I cut this characteristic class? Oh, you want me to do that case? Okay. Well, let me just say a word about that. So, I said what happens in three dimensions. Well, now suppose that I have a surface. So again, closed and oriented. Okay, so it doesn't have to be a boundary, by the way, although they are. And, right, so if I have a principal bundle over Y, then what is this class L of P now? Well, what L of P gives you is, well, the way I did it, it's an R mod Z, but if you allow me to sort of exponentiate, then what I get is what we might call a circle torsor, which we can just think of as a Hermitian line. So I claim that this characteristic class gives you something, that you're allowed to factor this number. Think of this exponentiated number. This is a complex number. And I want to, if I have this bundle on a three-manifold, this covering space, then on the closed manifold, we get a complex number. But I want to say that I get a number on each side. Say that's x prime and x double prime. I'll get an e to the 2 pi I on that side, and e to the 2 pi I on that side. But these are no longer complex numbers, but rather they live in a complex line. And that line just depends on the bundle restricted to the place where I cut this boundary. So that's the sense in which I can factorize. I can't factorize as a number, but I pick up a more interesting structure, a complex line. Okay? And that complex line is defined anyway for a surface. I don't need the three-manifold. But I can glue, if you like, just take the Hermitian inner product, and that recovers the number for me on the closed manifold. No, not in this case. It's topological. That's a different lecture. I would rather tell you something else, more complicated, but I'm happy to tell you that afterwards, I think. Well, okay, here's the rough idea. Imagine that this bundle has sections, which it doesn't, but this is the kind of construction that would work for SU2 Chern-Simon, SUN Chern-Simons. So if I were to give you a section, then that will trivialize this line. So what I have to give you is a cocycle that relates two different sections. But two sections, if they're related by a homotopy, that's a three-manifold, a three-cycle, a three-chain that relates them. So you see, I get back a number by integrating over that, so to speak. Well, you can't do that in this finite group case, but you can do the same idea if, for example, you represent things as singular cycles in the classifying space of BG. Just think about maps and taking boundaries. So we could construct the map, the line map. Okay. So, well, as long as I started here, you see, then the picture one gets here is that we have the space of bundles, P, over our two-manifold, Y. Think of that as a kind of discrete collection. And we've got a lot of symmetries. These are the gauge transformations between these bundles. And now we said that we have a Hermitian line every time I give you a bundle, we have a Hermitian line L sub P. So that's what this exponentiated classical action is here. We could still have a measure down here, which is 1 over the number of automorphisms of P, and of course that's gauge invariant. And we could still make sense of this sum. That's the sense in which the path integral makes sense, even in this dimension 2. And what does this sum mean? Well, see, here I'm summing Hermitian lines. Well, a Hermitian line, I can sum, I get a vector space. But what does it mean to take a positive number times a Hermitian line? Well, I just mean scale the Hermitian metric. Just multiply the metric by a positive number. So this is a sum of Hermitian lines with the metric scale. And if you think about it, if that were a finite sum, we'd just be talking about a vector, a line bundle over a finite set of points. That's just the space of L2 sections of that bundle. It's precisely the space you would put in quantum mechanics. So you can think of an L2 space as being a path integral, much the same way that you can think of computing this number as a path integral. That was actually the observation that started off and then continued that to lower dimension, and that's what I want to tell you. So, here again, I'm going to summarize lots of constructions and not give you them. The constructions aren't hard. And so let's go to the case of a circle. So my manifold is a circle. So we're now down to dimension one. We expect from that chart to construct the category. But what is the space of fields? Well, if I have a principal bundle over the circle, then supposing I pick a base point. So my principal bundle in this case is some sort of cover. And I mean that I pick a base point in the cover. Well, all our manifolds are oriented. And so I can go around the circle, and I come back to some other point, and therefore I get a number in the group. And that number is telling me the holonomy. And once I've picked this base point, there are no automorphisms, because any automorphism that fixes a base point is the identity over the circle. So that completely rigidifies, and the circle, the fields then, are equivalent to knowing the holonomy G. Well, those are the fields if I put in the base point, but we don't want to put in the base point. That's certainly not a local operation. So how do I get rid of the base point? Well, the group G acts on the base point, so this should be a quotient by the G action, and so I get a quotient like that, and the way it acts on the holonomy, as we know, is by conjugation. So I get the group acting on itself by conjugation. That's the general picture if I have any connections for any group G over the circle. So this is, again, a groupoid. We might picture it as a set of points. These points are the group elements, X. And then we have arrows. So for every group element, we also have an arrow that starts at X and takes me to some conjugate of X. So, for example, the self arrows at any point, those are the centralizer of X. The self arrows at the identity, that's the group itself. The components in this picture are the conjugacy classes. And in fact, if you've ever studied finite group theory, things like the Sillow theorem, this is a picture you study. So, so how do I get out of this classical picture? What does my functor F tell me to do? Well, in the case when the level is zero, and there's sort of no, that's allowed for a finite group, then in fact what we get is the category of G vector bundles over G. So again, I'm not going to explain why that's the right answer, but this is a category where an object here is a collection of vector spaces, Wx, W, well, if I call this Y, that's Y inverse XY. That's how it's going to be later. So this is Y inverse XY. And we have linear maps covering them. They're equivariant vector bundles. Okay. So that turns out to be the right thing to attach to the circle. And there are different ways in which we can represent this. Let's call G this groupoid. This groupoid of these arrows, really. And let's call C of G the path algebra, groupoid algebra, I'm not sure what the name is. But it's an algebra whose elements are complex linear combinations of the arrows. And the way I multiply two arrows, if they don't compose, the answer is zero. And if they compose, the answer is the composed arrow. So if I do that for the just a group, I get the group algebra, everything composes. This is a generalization. And you see, this thing can be identified with the category of representations, modules, over that algebra. So this category is a category of modules over an algebra. So that's a nice way to get a one category, is a category of modules. And this path algebra, well, so there's a lot more structure in this picture. But the point I want to emphasize is that the structure in this example is computed from the classical picture. It's computed from these fields and so on. So, for example, if we just look at this manifold, which is a pair of pans, so I'm thinking of this surface as a bordism where the two inner circles are incoming and the outer circle is outgoing, then if you do the path integral on this, you look at these various bundles, you see the restrictions to the boundary, you look at path integral with boundary, means you fix boundary conditions, you study the ones that extend them, and you really do that, then you discover that this thing produces a monoidal structure on this category of vector bundles. So you get a product that if I take two vector bundles, W1 and W2, I get a new vector bundle. And the fiber at X is the sum over group elements X1, X2 that equal X of W1 at X, tensor W2 at X2, 1. So this is a convolution product, if you like. And you can check that you start with an equivariant bundle, then there's a natural way to make this into an equivariant bundle. So that manifold makes this into a monoidal category, and that monoidal structure in turn gives a coproduct on this algebra. So it's the start of making this into a Hopf algebra, and so this thing ends up being a Hopf algebra. Or maybe it's called quasi-Hopf. For example, there's a ribbon element which is computed from a diffeomorphism that exchanges these two. Okay. So no, Hopf algebra. So this ends up being a braided monoidal structure. So the braiding comes from the diffeomorphism of the disk that exchanges these. And again, you can compute that, and that braiding structure on the category induces, read off an R matrix here that induces that braiding. Then there's a ribbon element that has to do with the rotation of the Dane twist and so on. So you read all that structure off geometrically is the point. For L equals 0, right. So I was going to say, what happens when L is not 0? When L is not 0, then what you get is a central extension, we might call GL, of G, or a central extension by the circle. So, I'll draw it again. So the way to think about that is that we have that attached to each of these arrows, now, so let's call this arrow F, mapping between X and Y, I suppose, then we have a line L sub F. So this L sub F is, again, let's say a Hermitian line. But these Hermitian lines have a composition law, that if I have another arrow called G, then I get a line L sub G. And if I compose, Greg, I hope that's OK, then I have a specified isomorphism with LG tensor LF. And furthermore, when I have three arrows that compose, then I get an identity among these isomorphisms, kind of co-cycle condition. So that's what an element of H4BG gives us here. It gives us these lines, this central extension of G. And what's the correct thing here? Well, it's going to be a twisted version of these. So this is going to be a collection of, again, vector spaces W of x. But now our linear maps like this, it's no longer equivariant, but we're going to get maps from, let's say, L sub f tensor W of x to W of y for an arrow f that goes from x to y. So in the equivariance, we actually have a twisting by this L. And again, those have to compose and so on and so on. So again, the kind of path integral, if you like, reads off that particular answer. My regret, I didn't recognize it at the time, is twisted K-theory, because that's exactly what that is. The L's are giving you a twisting of K-theory. But I want to say that this is, again, the module category for some algebra, AL, where this AL is some kind of twisted version of the thing we had before. Now, what we had before is actually what's called the Drinfeld double of the group algebra of the finite group G. And so this thing is a twisted Drinfeld double of the group algebra. And this particular twisted Drinfeld double was already in the literature in a paper of Robert, Dykgraff, Pasquier, and Roche, who did it kind of in this context, also in the context of orbifolds, but definitely, you know, related also to three-dimensional field theory. And so they wrote out, in terms of generators and relations, this formula for the, this twisted algebra. And one of the things that I wanted to do in this paper was actually to recover their formula. And I'll just mention that, I could go a certain distance towards recovering their formulas by what I've said so far, that, you know, that really to recover it, I had to choose certain kinds of bases in the various spaces that occur. And in the end, I had to use a gluing law along corners. So for example, to compute the things relevant to that pair of pans, it was quite useful, in fact essential, to construct the pair of pans from a disk. So you can construct the pair of pans from a disk, but only if you allow yourself to glue along corners. And so if we imagine we have a TQFT that's really 0, 1, 2, 3, four tiers, so I can go all the way down to point in this gluing, then you get much stronger gluing laws. And as I said, I wanted to say something concrete. I'm not telling you the computation, but I'm telling you about the computation, that really to get the actual formulas for the Hopf algebra, it required this kind of gluing. So that was one place where this extra structure gave you something concrete. Now, I want to spend the rest of the talk telling you about what's attached to a point. And first, to finish off the story with this finite group case, so we want to go down to sort of x equals a point. Well, what are the fields on a point? Well, there's only one principal G bundle over a point, but it has automorphisms, G. So really, the fields over a point is point mod G. It's a copy of the group. But copy of the group is automorphisms, not as the points of a space. And so again, we have this class L in H4BG. And now to tell you what structure I get here, I want to write this as H2 of BG with coefficients in, let's call it pick. Where what's pick? Pick is, well, it's the Eilenberg-MacLane space KZ2, or it's the category of complex lines. So grant me that little license that H4 is H2, like that. And you see, this is an abelian group. Well, it's a category, but it's an abelian group. I can tensor two lines, and that operation is as symmetric as you want. So that's like an abelian group. Now, what is a class in H2 of a group, group cohomology, just for a finite group, with coefficients in an abelian group? That classifies a central extension of the group. So this should be a central extension of G by, with kernel, complex lines. So this should give a central extension of G by complex lines. Now, how do I write a central extension of a group? Well, we write it as a cocycle. So the cocycle, in this case, will take values in lines. So the cocycle is something that depends on two group elements. So I'll have a collection of lines, k, x, y. So these are lines depending on two group elements. And what's the cocycle condition? Well, if I take k, x, y and tensor it with k, something like x, y, z, for any three group elements, then I should have an isomorphism with k, x, y, z, tensor y, z. So this is an isomorphism, let's say omega x, y, z. So that's part of the data. And then there's a consistency if I give you four group elements. There's an equation among those things. Well, now we can see why this is a class where I said it was. Because, you see, these are just lines, a finite collection of lines. So pick non-zero elements in these lines. If I pick a basis for each of these lines, then this omega xyz becomes a number, a non-zero complex number. And the identity for four group elements is precisely the cocycle equation for that. So I get a three cocycle in the group with elements of C star, and that's where I started. So this is a geometric way of encoding it. But now let's look at the category R, which we'll call vector G. And so these are just collections, Wx, of vector spaces here. So these are vector bundles over G. Okay. But I want to give this a monoidal structure. So again, this is starting to look like the group algebra, this time of the group G, not of that groupoid. No, these are just ordinary vector bundles, no equivariant. So I just have the group G. And for each x, I have a vector space, Wx. That's it. OK. So as a category, we know what that is. But now I want to give a monoidal structure. And the monoidal structure is that if I take W1 times W2, and I evaluate at x, well, the standard sort of monoidal structure is the one I wrote down before, convolution. We'll have W1 at X1, tensor W2 at X2. And then I want to twist by exactly these X1, X2, by the central extension K. And this equation, these isomorphisms, are going to go into proving that this is associative, as usual. So you see this class in H4BG here, it doesn't give me a twisted version of the ordinary group algebra. But it twists the group algebra with coefficients in vector spaces in the sense that it twists the monoidal structure. And I want to claim that this is what's attached to Chern-Simons at a point, for this case, for the finite group, that this should be this category R, this monoidal category, or if you want, maybe even the two category of modules over that one category. Pardon me? Over the points, yeah. How do I see Oh. Well, what's non-trivial, if you want, is the omegas. The omegas. I mean, it's the k's together with the omegas. So again, if I trivialize the k's, just pick a basis, then the omegas become numbers, non-zero numbers. And those numbers obey a cocycle identity. And that's the data. Right. And that's all provided by the same L, which is our data that gives the whole classical theory. All right. What's that? Well, so before we encountered one category, these, wherever it was, this thing, which I said is modules over an algebra. So even though we're talking about categories, we really have an algebra here. So here I have the analog of an algebra is a monoidal category. So we could get a two-category if we want by taking its modules. Or we might just think that that one category was good enough in some way. If you check associativity, then you'll use the omega. And if you check the kind of consistency, you'll have one level further to check, because you're one categorical level. You'll use the fact the omega is satisfied cocyclical identity. Mm-hmm. Well, K, if you want. Yeah, so K, if you like, is a vector bundle over G cross G. Right? It's just a finite set of points, G cross G, but nonetheless, it's a vector bundle over G cross G, together with that data. Well, that data comes, if you think about this formula, and think about having three things, W1, W2, W3, right, and multiply in the two different ways, you can put the parentheses. And then, if you want to see that the two answers are the same, you'll need to use that isomorphism. So that could be a motivation for it. That's right. I mean, you'll need the isomorphism omega to define the associativity of this monoidal structure. So in other words, when we have a composition on a set, it's a property to say it's associative. When we have it on a category, it's extra data to give the associativity. Is there, to define a what? Oh, you want to think of it? I don't know. I don't think I thought about that. I'm just thinking of one theory at a time. You're asking me about maps between theories, right? Yeah, okay. I'm already behind. Okay, so the last thing I want to say about the finite group case is, how do we recover from f of a point? We should be able to recover f of the circle. So f of the point is this monoidal category, this ring of vector bundles over the group, and the f we have of the circle are equivalent vector bundles over the group. And there is a process that recovers that, and it's a categorification, if you like, of the process that constructed this Drinfeld double, this group algebra of this groupoid, from the group algebra of the group. So the definition, if let R be a monoidal category, then the Drinfeld center Z of R consists of pairs X, beta X, where X is an object in R, and beta X is a functor, a natural transformation, natural isomorphism that, let's say, for any object Y, gives an isomorphism from X tensor Y to Y tensor X. So it's an isomorphism of two functors, which is left tensoring by X and right tensoring. So in other words, we're saying X is a central element. Multiplying on the left and multiplying on the right are the same. The tensor here means the product in R. And, it has to have a nice property with respect to braiding, if you like. This is a braiding past a product. So if I first braid past Y, and then I braid past X, past Z, rather. So we have to have that property. So that's the definition of the Grünfeld center. And the claim, the easy check, is that what I called f of s1 is the Grünfeld center of this R. But to do that, so you remember that this this category involves these lines L's attached to single group elements, attached to arrows. And this one involves involves a K, which is also attached to two group elements. And we can give a formula for one in terms of the other. And let me just give the formula, where L of an arrow F is the ratio K, KXY over KY, Y inverse XY, where F is an arrow that goes from X to Y inverse XY. So that is. Okay. So that is not hard. You just have to write this down. You'll see that when you take your arbitrary W, this vector bundle over the group, you want it to be central. You have to tensor it past any other vector bundle. Just take this one to be a kind of test delta function, just a one-dimensional vector space at one point. And then you'll see the various, you'll see two different lines K coming up. And so that's how L becomes the product of one with the inverse of the other. So yes, in general I didn't say, but I should have, that Z of R is in fact braided. I should also say that there's a recent paper of David Ben-Zvi, David Nadler, and John Francis, which takes this idea of a Grünfeld center and takes off with it in lots of directions. All right. What is what? It's not symmetric, but let me at least try to say something about the torus case if I could. Okay, so let's go on to the second topic, which is G T a torus. So the idea is that we're going to generalize this answer that is computed for a finite group, but there's a new kind of element that enters. So let me try at least to say something about the geometry of H4 of BT, because that's quite a pretty picture. So let's let T be the torus. I'll set up all sorts of notation. T will be its Lie algebra. That's a vector space. And then there are two natural lattices we get. I'll call pi hom from the circle into the torus. That's the same as H1 of the torus. That's the same as H2 of the classifying space of the torus, all in a natural way. So this is a lattice, z to the r, if it's an r-dimensional torus. And there's a dual lattice, lambda. These are homomorphisms from the torus back to the circle. That's the character lattice. That's in a natural way, the really natural H upper 1 of T. And this is H upper 2 of BT. And if I differentiate such a homomorphism, then this lattice sits inside the Lie algebra, just the velocity vector. And if I differentiate here, I get a linear function on the Lie algebra. So this thing sits inside the dual. I definitely don't want to identify them. Now, what is H4 of BT? Because remember, that's our starting data. In this finite group case, it's permissible to take that class H4BG to be 0. But in this case, it's certainly not. So we certainly have to understand what this is. Well, this is, in a natural way, sim 2 of the lattice lambda. So what is BT, first of all? Well, imagine the case when T is just the circle group. Then BT is CP infinity. You know the entire cohomology is polynomials in the class X of degree 2. So that class X of degree 2 is the generator here. X squared, that's the symmetric square, is the generator here. And if you have a product of CP2s, well, that's what it is. OK, this thing can be identified with quadratic functions Q from pi to z, which are quadratic, and satisfy the Q of n times a group element pi is n squared Q of pi. And given such a quadratic, what does it mean to be quadratic? It means that we get out of it a bilinear pairing. Namely, if I have two group elements, pi 1 and pi 2, then this is Q of pi 1 plus pi 2 minus Q of pi 1 minus Q of pi 2. And this pairing is then symmetric and even. Evenness follows from here. So that's what a class in H4 of BT is. It can be viewed quite concretely as that data. And let's see what that gives us. Well, to go further, and that's certainly part of the assumption in the Chern-Simons. If you like, it's the analog in Chern-Simons of the condition that says d squared L divided by q dot I, q dot j is a non-degenerate matrix in classical mechanics. The condition is that that if I take this thing on the Lie algebra, on pi, sorry, tensor R, that this is non-degenerate. So this is an assumption. It's a non-degeneracy assumption on the level L, on this cohomology class. Well, that means that this defines a map from pi to lambda. Well, any bilinear form defines a map from pi to lambda. It's symmetric, so there's no problem about the definition. Let's call this map tau. This thing is actually injective. And it says that if I tensor over R, then I get a map from the Lie algebra to the dual Lie algebra, because that's where these lattices sit. And this is an isomorphism. So we can invert it. OK? So that's our starting data. Now, as in the finite group case, we'll construct from this data two Lie bundles over T cross T. So this K will be a cocycle. So again, it comes with extra data, which are these isomorphisms. So and the L is kind of bihomomorphism. So the L, which I'll focus on, comes with data that looks like the data that I told you before about the L attached to the arrows, namely that L of x, y, z comes with an isomorphism to L of x, y, tensor L of x, z. If we think of the picture I had before of G acting on itself by conjugation, then the torus is abelian, so all the arrows are self-arrows. And so you should think of this as being associated to a self arrow. So what this gives is, for fixed x, we get a central extension. Sorry, well, you get a similar equation if I exchange the variable. Well, that I'm not telling you, partly because I'm out of time. You can, given L, this class in H4BD. Not quite, I think. I really want the quadratic thing. That's really my class. I need that. So, well, no, it's OK, as long as that form is even, I guess we'll be OK. OK, so for x fixed, we get a central extension of the torus by the circle. You see, we get a line bundle. If x is fixed, we get a line bundle in the second variable, and it multiplies like this. That gives us a central extension. And let's define a lattice, lambda x. Well, it's not quite a lattice, is a lambda torsor of splittings. So an element here is able to be a splitting like that. That's a homomorphism from this torus to that circle. It's a character here, but it's a character which on the central circle is just the identity. So those, if you like, are characters of projective representations. So that's a torsor over ordinary representations. So I just wanted to get to this following picture, which is this, that we have our torus. Think of this as the x variable in the torus. And for each x, I have now a central extension of this torus. And in turn, I have this lattice. Just picture this as like an r-dimensional lattice. It doesn't have a zero. It's an affine copy of this. And so as the x moves, these form a bundle. Let's call it C for bundle of characters, a bundle over T, which is a principal bundle with structure group lambda. Okay. Now, that's given by, of course, this is a flat bundle, so there's a holonomy. Well, the fundamental group here is just pi, and that has to go into the structure group lambda. So I have a holonomy, which is a homomorphism from pi to lambda. Well, of course, that's tau. So this, therefore, can be constructed by taking the universal cover, which is the Lie algebra, and crossing over the structure group, which is pi for the universal cover, with lambda by this homomorphism tau. Okay. And once you see that picture, well, this is projection onto the t factor, where I mod out by pi. So there's another projection where I mod out by, where I project onto lambda, but mod out by pi. So this projects onto lambda mod tau of pi. And this is, of course, a finite group. So we have this lattice sitting in this lattice, and the quotient is a finite group. So we have this kind of correspondence picture. So over this finite group, we have affine copies of the Lie algebra. So there's a zero, which really is the Lie algebra. And that's the map in this direction. So this is a principal bundle T, if you want. And in the other direction, it's an affine bundle for T. And in the other direction, well, we're projecting onto the torus. So these things wrap around. It's a bunch of different covers, and the sheets of the cover are parameterized by this. Okay. There's also in this picture a section, S. And S is most easily described by a formula, just telling you what it is for lambda. In here, it's just I have to give you an element to the Lie algebra. Well, that's tau inverse of lambda, and then lambda itself. So that section means that we have distinguished points. We, of course, have zero on that sheet, but we have other distinguished points. And finally, those points project down to the torus to give a finite group, F. Okay. So that's the picture you get from a class in H4 of BT. And now I truly am out of time. There's one formula I wanted to write, but I guess I won't have time to write it, to explain this isomorphism. But let me just say what the idea is. So the idea is that we're going to define a monoidal category R as we did before. So in the finite group case, these are just vector bundles over the group. And now I want to take the same thing, kind of vector bundles over the torus, only not vector bundles, but rather sheaves. And in fact, sheaves that are just completely trivial, that they're just supported at a finite set of points where they're finite dimensional complex vector space. So an element here is a collection of vector spaces for x and t such that wx equals zero for all but finite remaining x. So it's just a sheaf with finite support. So we might call it a finite sheaf on with heat somehow. And now I want to define the tensor. I want to define it as a monoidal category. And the formula is exactly the same as before. So I use these k's, which is this cocycle, to define that multiplication just as before. And now we can compute what is the center. So we might think that this is a good model. So what is this a model of, by the way? This is a model of k-homology. K-cohomology are vector bundles. K-homology are sheaves. These are particular simple kinds of k-homology classes, but they're twisted k-homology classes because of this k. Kind of Graham-Segal-like model for those. So you should think of it as topological. When these vector spaces coincide, they become the direct sum. Okay, now what is the center of this? Well, if you think back to the other case, the center gave us an equivariance. Well, here equivariance just means that we have a representation of T, because T acts trivially. Well, the characters of T are exactly what's on this space here. So starting with a vector down here, having a representation of its centralizer is exactly picking a character up here. So in fact, these are the same finite sheaves, but on this cover, C. That's what introduces the characters. Well, what we'd like to get is the modular tensor category that we would attach to the circle that defines this Torl-Chern-Simons theory. But that tensor category has only a finite number of objects, whereas this one has whole continuums of objects. In fact, the simple objects should be parameterized exactly by this finite set of these orbits, or this finite group F down here. And what we seem to get instead, not seem to get, what we get instead is a whole continuum. So we have to have a way of cutting down where we just get a single simple object. And the way to do that is not to take the center of R, but rather to take the centralizer in R of something else. And so I'll just end with that remark that the key is to replace by the centralizer in R of something else, and what is E, where E are just the finite sheaves on the Lie algebra itself. So on this thing, we can consider the finite sheaves. We again have a twisted convolution using this K, and we could consider the centralizer of those. And the centralizer of those, by the formula I didn't write down for you, exactly picks out beautifully these points. And so this thing ends up being the finite sheaves supported exactly on these points. And from that, you read off the braiding and even the ribbon element, which is part of the modular tensor category. That's all here as part of this Torl theory. So that's our candidate for Chern-Simons of a point, at least in the case of a torus. Okay, thank you. Well, lambda mod pi is the discriminant group. Right. Also, that will come, yeah, that came in the formula I didn't write. That formula comes if you, okay, I'll write one formula. See, supposing I have an xi and a lambda in here. Well, it's mod pi, but supposing I have an xi in here, an element of the Lie algebra, and a lambda in this lattice, then that has to give me a character. So the character, remember, is something on this central extension defined by x, which is the exponential of xi. But having chosen xi, I actually trivialize this. Let's pick a different trivialization. So the character becomes really a character on T, ordinary character. And in fact, I can write it as an infinitesimal character, which means a function of another Lie algebra element xi prime. And that element, that formula ends up being, so there's only one formula in my talk, and I couldn't remember it, but it ends up being xi over 2 minus lambda, or really tau inverse of lambda, inner product at psi prime. But you see, if you take it on the diagonal, which is this kind of ribbon element, then you're going to see xi squared. And that's the quadratic form that you want to see. So you're actually going to see that, which ends up being the ribbon element. And this formula ends up giving you also the braiding, which is the braiding structure. So all the structures that you know in that modular tensor category actually come from that picture. Yeah. Oh. Well, that's a good question. Of course, the torus is very special because conjugacy classes are points. I should mention that this finite group, these are the special conjugacy classes, which in general are called Verlinde conjugacy classes in this problem. Okay. So if we want to make a model of something like this for a general group along these lines, then we can't just take sheaves which are finitely supported, because when we take the center, we're going to get equivariant sheaves, as we saw in the finite group case. And those, the minimal objects, will have support along a conjugacy class. So they won't be finitely supported. So we'll have to work at least with vector bundles supported on a submanifold, on a conjugacy class. So we have nice models, of course, for those things. That was part of our work with Constantine and Mike about twisted K theory and constructing actually explicit geometric models for those twisted K classes, these kinds of Dirac families. So it's possible that some extension like that might work, but that I don't know. It's also possible, I suppose, that we could bring in the Weyl group and try to do something simpler here with finite sheaves and just do it with the Weyl group, but I have no excuses for not having thought more about that. Oh, David. Yes. Well, I think that to really do this, you have to expand a little bit what you think a field theory is. And so so if I just assigned R, then its center would be the wrong thing, as I said. So we can't just assign R. So somehow we're assigning this pair, which consists of R and E together. E meaning, if you want a sub-algebra of the center of R, really, that we're taking the commutator with respect to. So I'd like to say that that's the thing we attach to a point, is that pair. But really, we should be thinking of a field theory. So to start, when I had a two-tier field theory, just a 2-3 field theory, it's a functor from a Bordism category to one category of vector spaces. Well, here we have the 0, 1, 2, 3 theory. So we have to think of a richer Bordism category where we can do the kinds of gluings I mentioned before along corners. And on the other side, we should map to a 3 category. But we needn't strap ourselves. I think that's one of the newer insights in this game, is that we needn't strap ourselves to be thinking of that 3 category as being complex numbers, two categories, one categories, vector spaces, and so on, that we're really allowed to think of more general kinds of 3 categories. In particular, that 3 category might consist of simpler things that aren't 2 categories. Maybe they're just 1 categories. So that fits into a generators and relations picture, which I didn't have time to tell you, which is a conjecture of Baez and Dolan that Hopkins and Lurie have proved in dimensions, unfortunately, up to 2, not including 3, but there's a plan anyway. That Jacob has to go beyond. But in that picture, certainly it's a very general picture where the target category can be somewhat quite flexible. And so here, I think what you would assign to a point is this pair, R and E, and that would be the objects in some kind of 3 category. But so E, more precisely, is a monoidal category that comes equipped with a functor to the center of R. And then we can take the center of R relative to E. So what we mean by that is, so that'll be a monoidal, it turns out, but defined as a subcategory of this center, consisting of objects X, such that we call that functor G, You see, now we have a natural way to do this. Because first we have the braiding of X, but now we have the braiding of G of E. And we ask that this be the identity for all E. So that defines the subcategory, okay? And that's the one where if you compute using the formula that I just wrote down, you can compute that you get, in this case, beautifully, you just get the sheaves on those points. Constantly. It'd be nice to motivate this more closely from a classical picture like that. But I think that's right. I mean, with finite groups, the point is that the path integral is just a finite sum. But when you do path integrals, you know, in general, well, the path integral to get a number, who knows, the next path integral, so to speak, to get a vector space, there's the whole story of polarizations and geometric quantization and so on. So you need something more. That's kind of the analog of regularization of the measure, is putting in those polarizations. And so here, there's something like that, because we're now in the torus case, where we expect something more.
And I remind you that